Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. One of the teachings from the Buddha revolves around looking at how dukkha arises in our experience, particularly along the lines of this quality that we try and exert in our lives, a quality of control that underlies how we create a sense of self. Kind of the misunderstanding, basic misunderstanding of how to use this quality of control, because most of the time we try and control experience in our lives to maximize the pleasant, minimize the unpleasant. And it's through this misunderstanding of what we have control over and what we don't have control over underlies this perception of self and also causes us to act in habitual ways that result in dukkha. I think about that and contemplate that a fair amount, the issue of control. What is it that we have control over? What is it that we don't have control over? Do we have any control? Do we have absolute control? Do we have absolutely no control? And, you know, what is it anyway? What is control? Acting on a desire, usually, in the most habitual ways that we operate, it's acting on a desire using certain mental qualities with intention as the base, that sense of being able to will something into existence or will something into non-existence to control our experience. Using intention, attention, all the mental factors, the different ways that the mind and body work, we act usually on habit, using these qualities to increase the pleasant and decrease the unpleasant. So the question arises, is how much control do we really have? And over what? In a number of the teachings, most notably one that we chant fairly often, the Anattalakkhana Sutta, teaching on not self, that whole first section is around the issue of control. You know, starting out with the form khanda, the khanda of the body, and going through the mental or mind khandhas as well, that starting out with form is not self. If form were self, then it wouldn't lead to affliction. And one might be able to say in regards to form, let it be like this, let it not be like this. But since form isn't self, body isn't self, it therefore does lead to affliction, and one can't rightfully say, let it be like this, let it not be like this. So pointing right there and going through feelings, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness, with that same formula, pointing out that there is no ultimate control over these aspects of experience. In their ultimate sense, they're all not under the control of any self, any personal control. And that teaching is it's a teaching, it's a reflection, it's a way to loosen the sense of self, loosen the sense of permanence, and loosen the sense of ultimate control that we carry around with us. It's not necessarily a dogmatic statement or a statement of fact that one has to believe and accept. as a doctrine, but more a teaching for reflection, to see if there's a way that we can loosen the grip of this sense of self that causes us so much suffering. So one of the teachings that I've read recently from Ajahn Jeff talks about it a bit, he makes a very, clear point that, in a way, in a relative sense, there are some things that we have control over. We have relative control over some things in our lives. If we didn't have any relative control, then life would be pretty chaotic, and we'd be pretty hopeless in terms of trying to end suffering. We wouldn't have, if there was no control over anything, then we wouldn't have the ability to redirect our lives, redirect our attention in ways that lead to less suffering. We wouldn't be able to learn new habits or new skills or new ways of applying our mind if there weren't some semblance of control. Yet, we also know that some of the teachings, like the one I just talked about, point in the direction of giving up that sense of absolute control, because they're in the world of conditions, there are certain things that are essentially uncontrollable, and to try and control them just leads to more dukkha. So the task becomes learning what it is that can be controlled, learning how to exert a sense of influence or a sense of in control in a way that leads to wholesome conditions, wholesome states of mind, positive experiences, and to be able to learn how to not react and not fall into old habits that lead to suffering. And then also to learn what it is that we really don't have any control over, so that we stop trying to do that, because that kind of intention, that kind of activity, that leads to dukkha as well. So I find that a number of the contemplations on the body and the mind around the five khandhas that I find are very helpful are just the contemplation of the body, starting with the contemplation of the parts of the body, going through them with a questioning mind, with an investigative mind around the issue of what do I have control over here in this body? What do I not have control over? How does that work? So using the framework or the structure of the contemplation of the parts of the body, it's real useful to go through those and look at the ways that we try and exert control based on unskillful mind states, maybe. Look at the what we can do, where we can exert some control that's going to serve us in a useful way, and where it's just not a good idea to try and assume that there is any control that one can exert over it. So with that kind of investigative mind, or with that kind of paradigm in mind, you can go through the parts of the body, just as we chant them, as we learn them. There's many different ways you can use that contemplation, not only to reduce sensual desire, or not only to use it as a samatha practice, calming the mind, but in a further sense, to use it for this investigation of anatta, not self, through the issue of control. So hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin. These are all the first five of these parts of the body that we bring into contemplation. These are the external parts, the parts that you can see by looking at yourself, by looking at other people. These are the parts that are the most apparent. and looking at them, investigating them with that focus in mind. What control is there in this body? And when do we try and exert control? Is it useful? Is it not useful? Hair of the head, looking at how that changes over time. Gets gray, gets brittle, falls out. But how much time does a lot of the world spend in trying to make that not happen through the desire for being physically attractive? How we cut hair, how people style their hair, color the hair, to make it attractive to ourselves, to other people, just for that purpose of personal attractiveness. But how much control over its ultimate nature do we really have? You really can't control baldness, hair falling out, or the thinning or the discoloration of it. It pretty much has a life of its own. We can make it look a little different for a period of time, but it can't really alter its course. Same with hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin. The nails eventually get brittle, old, turn yellow. Yet people try and make them attractive, you know, painting nails, shaping them in some sort of sense that's a cause for attraction. Or the teeth, you know, of the watching how the teeth change over time. Cavities come and gums start to deteriorate, teeth fall out sometimes. Can cause a lot of pain, actually, too. You know, going to the dentist office, sometimes you can see these advertisements for whitening teeth. People spend a lot of money taking these real kind of special treatments to, you know, see the picture on the advertisement of, you know, an attractive person with a big, broad smile of absolutely perfect, brilliant white teeth. And, you know, it's not to say one shouldn't try to take care of oneself or to, you know, not to go out of one's way to make oneself, you know, unbearably ugly. But how much time and effort and money do we want to spend on having beautiful hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin? Skin is a big one, you know. The amount of money that's spent on lotions and potions and moisturizers and defoliants and whatever else it is that we can spend money on. And then just to watch the inexorable decline and sagging of the face and the skin in the body, and how it try and tighten it up and keep it from getting all wrinkled, and yeah, just the amount of effort that's put into these five body parts. So we have a little bit of control over it, but not much in the long run. And just to contemplate that, watch the body in its external conditions around, in yourself and around in the people, just going through what bodies go through. All the muscles of the body. You know, a lot of people spend a lot of time exercising the muscles to build them up and puff them up and make them stick out in places where they don't stick out and make them not stick out in places where they do. But gravity has its way over years. And, you know, no matter how many facelifts and tummy tucks you get, eventually, gravity wins. All the internal organs of the body, you know, subject to their process. We have a bit of control, maybe, in caring for the body. And the Buddha does say we should, you know, have the right to, you know, to use certain medicines to help us keep, you know, relatively healthy, to treat disease. He doesn't forbid using that. He doesn't say, you know, just let it all go to to seed, let it all go to pot because it doesn't really matter anyway, nothing matters, so just don't even worry about trying to take care of your body. He doesn't say that. He says we can take care of the body so that we can use it for the purpose of spiritual practice, for the purpose of spiritual development. If we didn't have these bodies, we wouldn't have the capacity to keep on our exploration. So we can have some sort of influence over certain kinds of physical diseases, you know, heart disease, lung disease, all these kinds of things. But ultimately, how much control really is there? There's a relative amount of control, but not an absolute amount. And just feel the heart, feel the lungs, contemplate that as part of the body contemplation. When you're quietly sitting there, tune into the beating heart. If you're really quiet, you can feel the heart beating inside your chest. You can certainly feel your lungs expanding and contracting. And if you're caught in the delusion that you have, you know, control over this body, well, then try and stop breathing for more than a few seconds or a minute. Or try and stop your heart from beating. I'm going to try that right now. See if you can do that. Some people who are adept can control their heart rate a little bit, control some of their blood pressure. You can modify the quality of breathing, take deeper breaths or shallower breaths. But as soon as you don't have your attention on it, as soon as you turn your attention away, then the lungs resume their own natural way of contracting and expanding. The heart just keeps on beating. It's doing its own thing. Ultimately, you really don't have any control. It's these organs with their automatic processes are just following the nature of biology. And so it's the same with all those other internal organs and those other physiological processes that are happening. They happen according to their own nature. There isn't an ultimate ability to control that process. Processes of urination, defecation, I mean, those are really out of your control. I mean, who's in charge when your bladder is full? You know, just try and stay with that for a few hours of having a full bladder or needing to evacuate the bowels. They pretty much have a life of their own. There is a saying in Thailand, I think, that there's kind of three unstoppable processes in nature. One is a person who has to either urinate or defecate. The second one is a woman who is in the process of giving birth. And the third unstoppable thing is a monk who's intent on disrobing. But a little joke notwithstanding, kind of points out that there are a few processes that are unstoppable. So contemplate that, you know, what do you really have control over in this body? It's subject to illness. We certainly don't want to have afflictions and illness, because we don't really have any ultimate control, the body goes its own course, its own way of nature. And it's not meant to be a disheartening kind of contemplation. It's meant to be one that's actually really freeing, because if you stop this senseless attempt to control what happens with this body on an ultimate level, you can experience a certain sense of freedom in just being with nature as it is, working with it in a skillful way and supporting it in its ability to help lead us to spiritual insight, freedom, but not with a sense of really being able to control it. Same's true with the aspects of mind, the feelings, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness, feelings. In the Buddhist sense, the feeling that's part and parcel of any kind of contact with the sense world, any sight, sounds, taste, touch, tactile sensations, smells, and even mental experiences all come with a certain feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. How much control do we really have over those? For the most part, you know, each of those experiences in the sensory world comes with to a greater or lesser extent, a sense of pleasantness or unpleasantness or neutrality. And, there's not a lot of control over that. It's like when we were outside meditating and the chainsaw was being fired up, you know. There's a sense of, if you're enjoying the peace, which is generally a pleasant sound, you know, a pleasant feeling, a peaceful, quiet time where there's just a few sounds of nature, and then all of a sudden a loud, jarring noise comes, then that's unpleasant. But how much control do we have over that sound? We can't really say, unpleasant experience, go away. Unpleasant sound, go away. It's there. Or the people arguing or yelling at their kids or whatever it is. Not much control over that. Yeah, maybe they were saying the same thing about our chanting. Perceptions, the way that we identify experiences from the senses again, the labels we put on things oftentimes come from habitual ways that we think about things, or from our past experience. And, you know, we label certain things in certain ways as desirable or as undesirable, whether it's certain sensual experiences or people that we encounter, we form these mental images, these mental labels. And that process is pretty darn automatic, because over, you know, many years of experience, many lifetimes of experience, we develop these ingrained patterns of perception. You know, for a lot of the time, they're just pretty automatic. You know, a certain sound arises from across the street, and this image or this mental word or this some way of identifying it as chainsaw comes into the mind. It's a perceptual label. And with that label comes a certain mental impression as well of don't like it, do like it, you know, some sort of opinion around it often comes with that particular perception. So those are conditioned kinds of experiences in the perceptual world. And they're oftentimes, you know, not very controllable, not subject to our control. They're just there. And if we wish they were different, then we're going to suffer. Doesn't mean there isn't some relative controls that we can have, the Buddha, but it's usually more over time, reconditioning, reprogramming our perceptual process. The Buddha says that we can do that and actually encourage us to experiment with that and to see if we can retrain some of our perceptions. So if we see something that we would normally call attractive or beautiful, particularly something that we allow to kind of take over the mind with the force of craving or clinging in the sensual realm, then he says, well, you know, you can work on reestablishing a different kind of perception. You can reestablish a perception of unattractive or unbeautiful in that which we normally perceive as beautiful, to counteract that compulsive craving that can come around certain perceptions of beauty or desirability. If we find that those perceptions are controlling us, then we can slowly influence our ability to see them in a different way. Or similarly with things that are repulsive. So somebody that we find very difficult to be with, or some experience that is part of our lives that we find difficult. We can slowly try and reprogram our experience of that perception, try and re-perceive it in a way as something, seeing the beautiful or the poignant or the certain positive qualities in that which we usually hold as undesirable, unwelcome. Seeing, you know, just like in the case of somebody who's very difficult, not attending to the parts that we find repulsive or unpleasant, but attending to the skillful qualities, the abilities that they do have in a positive sense. So in a sense, retraining our perceptual process. That takes time, that takes energy, that takes a lot of skillful attention. So there is some influence that we can have, some ways that we do have some control over that. But we can't expect for ourselves to have an absolute kind of control over the perceptual realm, based particularly with those things that are the results of past action, vipaka, the results of karma that was set in motion in the past. There's always going to be some result from any kind of intentional action, and sometimes we don't have very much control over that. Although we do have a amount of control as to how we react to it, whether we react to it with suffering or react to it with a skillful way of attending to it that doesn't lead to suffering. The mental formations, the moods, the different kinds of trains of thought, the thought process itself, when it's the result of past action, past karma, sometimes there isn't a whole lot of influence that we have. I mean, how many times you sit there in a nice quiet meditation and the most bizarre thoughts start to just pop up, seemingly from left field, out of nowhere, just manifesting. You can be enjoying a relatively quiet state of mind, and then just out of left field, the strangest thoughts, strangest concepts, strangest words, the verbiage, the train of verbiage that comes can be pretty amazing. And really not with any sense of being able to control it. Or moods, certain moods, whether they're from, you know, sensory experiences, biological situations, past karma, whatever the cause, you know, certain moods come in, whether it's from habit or biology or whatever, you know, whether it's moods of anger or incredible desire or depression or elation, whatever the cause, if they're the results of these kinds of conditions, there isn't a whole lot of control that we can immediately exert into it. We can work on ways of not suffering with it, but really, where is the control in the mental world? other than establishing a sense of clarity around certain skillful mind states, developing, trying to influence the development of mindfulness, clear comprehension, qualities of mind that will help give us some sense of choosing certain pathways that will lead to skillfulness and lead to less suffering. We can influence. We can choose certain things to contemplate. And the talk that Lungpa gave last night about developing the paramitas, those are skillful ways that we can exert some control, some influence in our mental world. So learning to use our ability to exert some control in that realm, to develop those kinds of qualities, and to let go of the unskillful ones and the ways we react unskillfully. But also to realize when there are certain states of mind, certain mental conditions that there is no control over, and not to get lost in trying to influence those things. When we try and influence things or control things out of aversion, then it's going to backfire on us. Or when we try and control things to get what we want out of raw craving or raw desire, then it's going to backfire on us, because we just end up reinforcing habits that don't really give us any kind of long-term sense of satisfaction. We're just reinforcing old undesirable habits when we do it out of aversion or out of craving. Consciousness itself, with craving basically craving as the base, the attention will automatically land. Consciousness will land on any one of the six sense bases, and it's constantly shifting from one sense base to another, out of tanha. So this process is almost, essentially uncontrollable when there's a basis of ignorance or a basis of craving underlying the whole process of consciousness. It's almost an automatic process of moving from one sense base to another, seeking some sort of experience or seeking to get away from some sort of experience. It's kind of an automatic response. And you can contemplate that and watch that process happening. Watch the process of consciousness moving from the area of sights to the area of sounds. Or all of a sudden it's moving to tactile sensations and then back to sounds. A good smell passes through, and all of a sudden that's where the attention, the consciousness is. Or taste, when you're eating, the focus is on the tongue. But consciousness is always landing somewhere when it's under the influence of ignorance or craving. It's always moving from one to another, almost as an automatic conditioned response. How much control do we really have over that, as long as ignorance and craving are holding sway? So the idea is just to get a sense through looking through the aggregates, looking through our experience in a methodical way, with that intention of investigating where is it that I do have some control, and if I do have some control, can I use it in a skillful way to develop habits that will lead to a long-term sense of contentment and peace? Where can I stop trying to control things based on aversion, based on craving, noticing that when we try and do that, that it just reinforces old bad habits that just lead to more suffering. And lastly, where is it that I really don't have any control? Where should I just stop trying to control when it's, say, the case of physical illness, it's the body following its own course, or mental illness, mental deterioration, cognitive decline, certain kinds of moods and mind states that there isn't much control over. Can I be at peace with those and stop trying to control, stop trying to influence? You know, in an ultimate sense, all things conditioned are subject to their own way. And eventually, as we all know, I think that you know, the goal of the teaching is to be able to see the aspect of not-self in all experience, including all of the positive experiences, including all of the skillful mind qualities that we can develop along the path to help us on the path. Eventually they'll have to be let go of as well, and seen through the lens of anatta, the lens of not-self, and that there's no independent self-existent control over those. Again, we use certain mental factors to reinforce and to bring our attention, use our mindfulness and clarity to develop these spiritually skillful mental qualities. But all in all, they're also a part of the realm of conditions, which in the final word is something that we will learn to let go of as well in the process of relinquishment. That's where ultimate freedom will be found. But until that time, we need to consider the sense of control, use it skillfully when we can, let go of the things that we don't have much control over or any control over, and create a really strong and useful tool, a raft to get us across the river. And at that point, when we reach the other side, then we'll be able to let go of that as well. So these are just a few thoughts about issues of control, self, and some of the teachings around that, and offer that for people's contemplation tonight.
Sadhu Karanda Dhamma Seva.